そう。So let's start with a very simple question. What's the difference between resting in awareness of awareness and ascertaining awareness, of course, and ascertaining Rigpa, pristine awareness? And the answer is very short and very simple. It all has to do with the presence or absence of grasping. What kind of grasping? Dualistic grasping. Where does dualistic grasping come from? From reifying the subject, and therefore reifying this object, and therefore reifying the separation or difference between subject and object. So the difference is absolutely real, or is seen as such. So I don't recall whether I've run through the four types of mindfulness that are the landmarks of the path of taking the impure mind onto the path, also known as settling the mind in its natural state. So I'll run. Have I run through that in this? Didn't think so. Maybe yes, maybe no. Okay, I'm going to do it quickly because it's good just as a refresher. Very important, actually. Every single step is important. All of this is worth memorizing and totally assimilating. So prior to the first of the four of mindfulness is that which cracks open the door and allows you entrance into the practice, without which you have no access. Like you just don't have a ticket, is the ability to distinguish between stillness and motion, and specifically the stillness of your own awareness and the movements of the mind. Normally, for the totally untrained mind, whenever the mind is in motion, awareness is in motion. That is, cognitive fusion pervades everywhere. Whatever comes up, you totally fuse with it. Okay? So welcome to samsara without end, just an ongoing non-lucid dream. But if we cultivate that ability, again symbolized by the unflickering candle flame of stillness, and then noticing, observing, recognizing the movements of the mind, not only the images and thoughts, but also, of course, the subjective impulses, the desires, emotions, and so on. So then you've cracked open the door, and then you enter into the room, so to speak, with the first type of mindfulness, and it's called single-pointed mindfulness. And it is where, it's a type of mindfulness, very simply, in which you are simultaneously aware of the stillness of your awareness and the movements of the mind. And that does include the subjective impulses, which are, of course, much harder. But which means when an emotion comes up, you're not caught in its grip. When a thought comes up, you're not, your awareness is not kidnapped and directed off, propelled off. Something quite forceful, quite almost violent. I'm looking for a stronger verb. Propelled or cast off. No, that's another one. I can't find the word. But you know what I mean. That simultaneously you're aware of the movements, the thoughts, the images, the memories, the fantasies, without being hurled. There's the one I wanted. Without your awareness being hurled. If I hurl you off a cliff, you have no choice in the matter, right? You're just, I had total control of you, and I hurl you, right? Not a nice thing to do. And that's what our thoughts and images do. They hurl us off to the referent of the thoughts, memories, fantasies, and so forth. And then, so there's one, I like that one image a lot, for, you know, the compulsive aspect. Obsessively, they arise compulsively. We are hurled. The awareness is hurled off to the referent. And then in terms of the subjective impulses, Paul Ekman has the perfect image there. In the grip, that is, desires come, and we're in the grip of the desire. We're in the grip of the emotion. We all know what that feels like. But here, in contrast to that, you're already taking an enormous step towards freedom, right? And that is, awareness remains still. It's not hurled and it's not gripped. And again, when I think of gripped, the image that really always comes to mind is that of a like a trout or a salmon in the talons of a fish eagle or an eagle, right? Well, there's no free will there. Somebody's lunch, and the chances of that fish escaping from the talons as the eagle flies away are pretty much zero, right? So the first type of mindfulness is single-pointed mindfulness, indicated by your ability to simultaneously be aware of the stillness of your awareness and the movements of the mind. And you continue, you simply continue and become more familiar with that, and over the course of the time it becomes more and more effortless until you enter into a state of flow in that simultaneity of the awareness of stillness and motion. And then we call that manifest mindfulness. You're in the flow, right? Definitely another big step towards freedom. And that really carries you through like stages 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 in terms of stages of shamatha. That'll be a real keeper. You're going to be going flow, flow, flow all the way through. It's just going to get subtler and more effortless. Already in stage 4, it's not bad. You have some flow there. But then, you know, coarse excitation have been cast off, then medium excitation cast off, subtle excitation cast off. It just gets better and better, right? Of course, with a lot of bumps, that goes without saying. But then you're coming right towards the end of the track. And you enter into this anomaly. And that is the third type of mindfulness, being the mindfulness which is an absence of mindfulness. And that's considering that mindfulness is a mental factor. It belongs to the mind where it's embedded. The mind that you've been using all along, from the beginning right on through these first 9 stages, has been your coarse mind, your ordinary mind, your woman's mind, man's mind, and so on. And that one's shutting down. I mean, the contents of the mind have diminished. It's down to an ocean unmoved by waves. It's getting to be Mount Meru, totally still. And so the contents of the mind have faded out. Your 5 physical senses have imploded. And then you pass through this phase, it's relatively brief, where you're still wide awake. You've not fallen into a trance, so you've not become into a stupor. You've not lost the flow of cognizance. If you have, then it's just dullness. You've sustained that. But you're not bearing anything in mind, because all that you were attending to is gone, and now there's just a sheer vacuity. So that's not holding on to much. But most importantly, the mental factor of mindfulness, which belongs to among the 51 mental factors of your coarse mind, it's gone dormant. Your coarse mind has now shut down. It's very much like rebooting. That is, you've just shifted your computer to a higher operating system. But before you can use that, the old one has to shut down, and during the interim, your computer doesn't work. Now, it's not the same as having no computer or a broken computer. It's in transition, but it's no longer operative in the old operating system, and it's not yet operative in the new operating system, but it will be very soon. You have to be just patient and just cruise on through very transiently, right? And then the fourth and culminating type of mindfulness is self-illuminating mindfulness, where you were just focusing your awareness as usual on the space of the mind and its contents, but there were no contents. So you're just gazing into an open vacuity with nothing there except for the vacuity itself. And then you invert your awareness in upon itself. And then you're home. You've now identified the essential nature of your mind, or as Panchen Rinpoche said, the relative or conventional nature of your mind. You now know the nature of consciousness. But in the same way as knowing a cup, and that won't free you. But if, you know, philosophers and psychologists and neuroscientists and religious people have been pondering and writing about what's the nature of the soul, what's the nature of consciousness, and they have all kinds of ideas and so forth, you get there and you know. And it's no mysterious than recognizing a tomato. Really. You go into the grocery market, can you or can you not recognize tomatoes when you see them? If you can, then congratulations, you've identified the essential nature of tomatoes, because you're not mistaking them for other things that might look like tomatoes. It's on that level that consciousness is simply one more natural phenomenon. But if you have not identified it, then you'll just speculate indefinitely. Now, the crucial point here is you can't bring the baggage of your coarse mind down to that level. You can either stay operating in your coarse mind, where you're all comfortable, or, insofar as you're identifying with your coarse mind, die. If that's your basis of designation of you, and for many of us it is a lot of the time, die. Because you're going to lose your basis of designation. As it dissolves, vanishes. And you're rebooting that third type of mindfulness, and then another one comes up. So another basis of designation comes up. This is the substrate consciousness. This is the subtle continuum of mental consciousness. Now that can be your basis of designation of I. Right? Now that, again, you're not just abiding. This is so crucially important. You're not simply abiding in bliss, luminosity, and non-conceptuality. That's a very nice place to hang out for a little while. Like it's a reward. Here's your lollipop. But now that you're there, you've got all those five jhana factors. So get to work. You know, use them for heaven's sake. Single-pointed attention. Right? Single-pointed attention. Course investigation, subtle analysis, sense of well-being and bliss. Okay. Get going. Use those. But now this type of subtle course investigation and subtle analysis, this is operating on another whole plane than your ordinary one up in the coarse mind, right? It's still conceptual. So it said non-conceptual, but as I've said so many times, it's not completely non-conceptual. It just means it's not coarsely conceptual, totally caught up in language and so forth that you're used to. Now this turns out to be very important. This is why from the very beginning of settling the mind in its natural state, really any shamatha practice, but so explicitly, settling mind in its natural state, awareness of awareness, you want to go into a non-conceptual mode. I cannot emphasize this more strongly. You want to go into a non-conceptual mode where you're not cogitating, you're not figuring it out. Any more than when you put a piece of chocolate into your mouth, you're wondering about its chemical composition. Or you're, you know, acting as a chocolate critic and trying to figure out, is it Belgian, German, Swiss, or heaven forbid, English? Sorry, but they haven't looked. I have tasted some good English. Scottish, actually. The Scots know how to make. But, okay, I digress. Don't go there. Just enjoy the chocolate, right? If you can. And it's like that. You're just bringing this straight knowing in that's not clothed in your normal mode of cogitation and conceptualization. It's like that minnow, remember? Like the minnow that's just slipping through the water, just and without disturbing the water. It's not bringing all the baggage of your ordinary intelligence, language, analytical skills, and so forth. This is working on a subtler level. It's a higher operating system. And you don't get that as a bonus at the end without having it prior to that. You're cultivating it all the way through. From the first session, let's say in settling the mind as natural state, you're doing your best approximation of observing the activities of the mind from the perspective of substrate consciousness. You're not really, but you're doing your best approximation, and that approximation gets better and better and better until it's the real thing, right? Now, granted, you are, at the outset, observing your mind with your mind. You have no choice. But you are seeking to diminish or put out of work the ordinary activities of your ordinary mind and ascertain from a subtler level and also in a continuous fashion. That's the real deal. So it's come up earlier in the text, this incredibly brilliant text. I mean, I'm just enjoying it so much because I've not looked at it for a long time, not even in preparation to this retreat. I just figured I'll figure it out when I get there. But he said, whatever appears, the conceptual mind apprehends it. Well, this is standard Buddhist psychology. And that is, we have our five sensory modes, visual, auditory, and so forth. They're non-conceptual. That is, we have six modes of consciousness, right? And five of them are always non-conceptual. Your eye consciousness does not conceive of anything. It does not draw inferences. It does not cogitate. Your auditory consciousness, same, olfactory, gustatory, tactile, they're all perceptual, they're non-conceptual. And then we can ask, well then, why did he say that everything appears is apprehended with a conceptual mind, by way of concepts? Oh, because that's because in the very first moment, like I just direct my attention to Daniel, in that first moment, like really microseconds, in that first moment, boom, I'm just getting perceptual, like visual. And right now, of course, I'm attending to his face and I'm getting an ongoing flow of non-conceptual visual perception. So what's the problem? Somebody hitched a ride. Not in the very first moment, but ever so quickly right afterwards. Somebody hitched a ride. What is it, Brendan? Yeah, that's certainly true, but a bit more explicitly, I'm just going to tell you because I'm in a hurry. Mental consciousness. That is, I'm not just turning my eyeballs towards Daniel. I'm turning my attention to Daniel. So this means that, of course, my mental awareness, my mental consciousness, has hitched a ride, is parasitic on the visual perception. Well, the visual remains non-conceptual, perceptual. If I touched him on the shoulder, tactile remains non-conceptual, right? But it's got a parasite now. And the parasite is mental consciousness. And in the first moment, mental consciousness is perceptual. The second moment, it just kicks into its old habit. It goes into conceptual. And it overrides. It overrides. So my awareness of Daniel then is the mental awareness overrides. It infiltrates from my perspective. And my perspective is mental awareness. So my visual awareness of Daniel's face then is configured, veiled, screened, and so forth by concepts. I'm very familiar with human beings, with beards. I've lived in Germany, I'm familiar with German people, and so on. All of that comes, all of that is dumped on, right? And so that's why it's stated that whenever we turn our attention anywhere, it's always in a finger snap. The conceptual mind comes in and overrides, and so we're getting everything through that screen. And that screen will, because it's based on past history and so forth, it will highlight some things and lead to cognitive deficit in others. Happens all the time, all right? The father who cannot see that his daughter is just as capable academically as his sons. Well, he can see, but he can't see. Not because his eyeballs aren't working, because his conceptual mind is so ingrained in the notion that, well, girls can't do that. Everybody knows that, you know? And so then he can't see it. You know, and yet his eyesight are perfectly good, and he's very intelligent, but cognitive blockages. So, and of course people commonly report on seeing things they never saw, that never occurred. Happens all the time, hearing things that never occurred and so forth. Why? Conceptual mind jumps in and superimposes. And then you come back, I'm sure I saw this, I'm absolutely sure I saw. You said this, I know you said that. I'm sure, oh you didn't, okay. Show me the tape recorder. Yeah. Oh I didn't, okay. My mistake. So that's the point. But now we come back to Vipassana. We're now raising this to another whole level. And we're really close to the nucleus. We've already bumped into it, so let's not leave too quickly. And that is, we settle awareness in its natural state, okay? Should be familiar with that. And optimally, of course, you would have clearly identified the essential nature of your own mind. It would be like a chemist finding a completely pure strain of whatever kind of substance he or she is interested in investigating. No alloy, not mixed with anything else. Here's pure smallpox virus. Or here's pure gold. Here's pure, but just not mixed with anything else, and it's right there under the microscope. Okay, this is 100% what I want to be investigating. Without confusing with anything else, right? Well, that's what you got now. You have a mind that is supple, clear, lucid, non-conceptually cognizant, ready to investigate as soon as you wish to, and it's taking the specimen of awareness, got it right under the lens. Now you can rest there phenomenologically, and then you're just hanging out in shamatha, or you can bring out the big guns, and the big guns are searching, engaging in the search for the mind, which Padmasambhava taught us earlier. You recall, yeah? How many minds are there here as I'm observing awareness, as I'm observing the observer? How many are there? Two of us in here, there's more. And is one in nirvana, the other one in samsara? Is one enlightened, one samsaric? And of course, that's a conversation with dualistic grasping. The sense that as you're observing your awareness, but I'm going to rephrase that, as you're now not content simply to experience being aware, which heck, you can do on the first time, not a big deal. You're experiencing a verb, experiencing a process, not that hard. Are you aware right now whether you're conscious? Yeah, got it, you know. The one that really brings out the sharp knife is, are you aware of the one who is aware? The noun, or the referent of the noun. The one who is aware, that's a noun, and the observer. The one who's thinking, that's a noun. The thinker, the noun. The creator, the meditator. The one who's doing it. Now, look at Wendy, for example. Wendy looks at Wendy, and Wendy thinks, I'm thinking, I'm meditating. So she's designating herself as a person. She's a person. And she's designating that when she thinks, I'm meditating. Well, it's not really her body meditating. The body's just sitting there, right? So what's meditating? Her mind. On the basis of her mind, the basis of designation of mind, she designates herself. I'm meditating. Is Wendy's mind Wendy? Nope. Is Wendy's mind saturated by Wendy? Is there a Wendy in there? Nope. Wendy's mind is completely empty of Wendy. There's not even a trace, not even an atom, as they say, of Wendy in the basis of designation of Wendy. Whether she says I'm tall or she says I'm English or what have you, there's no Wendy in any of these bases of designation. Designate yourself in any way you like, and you'll never find any basis of designation that is not empty of you. Shock. But you can't designate yourself as a meditator unless you have a mind. And the mind is the basis of designation. So if we're really interested in what is meditating, I think we maybe just move right through I. Because I am meditating only insofar as there's a basis of designation, meditating, upon which I'm designating myself. So let's cut out the middleman and just go right to that which is meditating, with no reference to me, no personal pronouns. The mind is meditating, or awareness is meditating. You can use those interchangeably in this context. It's a noun. The one over here, who appears to be independent, and again, it's not indoctrination, it's asking, do you have that sense? That in here is something you may call mind, you may call awareness, or based using that as a basis of designation, you may call me. But just cut right through to the basis of designation. That is there not something here that is meditating, that is thinking, that is observing, that is witnessing, that is simply present? Is there not something here, and we can call it mind? And what is that agent? What is that, the referent of that noun that seems to be in here? And you bring out your sharp knife and you pierce that. You look for the basis of designation of your mind. Now you've really got to the core. Now it's almost game over. If this were a chess game, it would be like checkmate in one move. You're almost finished. You're almost finished. What's the basis of designation for mind? If you want to call it your mind, that's fine. And you identify that. And then, is that basis of designation empty of mind? Those individual moments of cognition, each one unconscious, 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 each 2-millisecond pulse, each one's unconscious. Cluster them, and we call it a moment of awareness. But each individual component, just like no soldier is an army, no individual pulse of 2 milliseconds is actually explicitly conscious. They have to cluster. Like you don't have a whole bunch of armies with one person. You have to have at least a few. I mean, it has to be quite a few, I think, to call it an army and not a squad or a platoon or what have you. An army is kind of like, okay, a lot of people. No one of them is, and simply having them there, scattered out across the field smoking cigars, that's not an army. You designate army, and yet there was nothing there in your basis of designation, actually an army. The army's empty. But come to the nucleus. When you see the basis of designation for what you conceive of as your mind, because bear in mind, as soon as you're looking, the conceptual mind's coming in to help and to take over, frankly. Right? Which means it's going to be designating, which means it will have a basis of designation. And when you look into that which is the basis of designation of mind, and you see it's empty of mind, and the mind that you've designated, of course, is a sentient being's mind, right? One of those bad ones, delusional ones, caught up in mental afflictions, right? It's the thing, the only thing, in fact, that makes you a sentient being. Because a Buddha could have a body like yours, no big deal, right? But a Buddha couldn't have a mind like yours. A Buddha can't have a samsaric mind. Then it's but not a Buddha. So when you look right in and you have that amazing opening that no mind. The mind is not the mind. The basis of the mind is not the basis of designation of mind. Semni semachite semgiranjanisawo. The mind is not the mind. The nature of the mind is clear light. And you see, that which you're designating, the mind, is not its basis of designation, is not the mind. Or the basis of designation of mind is not the mind. Then you see emptiness of mind. And in the shattering of that long-standing and deeply habitual reification of mind, and the shattering of that, then you may realize emptiness of mind. And I gave the analogy earlier of the four types of mindfulness, and that is you have to leave the baggage behind. You can't bring your coarse mind down there. And you must maintain a flow of cognizance. If you just space out, then okay, you've dropped the ball. Now, on a much higher level, you've just come to this not finding, but it's the not finding as in it's not to be found. It's a finding that is not there, that your mind is empty of being a mind. Then you need to rest there and sustain the flow of cognizance and leave your baggage behind. And the baggage is all conceptual elaborations. All your categories, all your constructs. Dunam loyi chuyu min, it says in the Shantideva, ninth chapter, wisdom chapter. The ultimate, as in the ultimate nature of your own mind, is not an object of the intellect. The intellect would like to swallow it. Well, intellect wants to swallow everything, just like the colonial powers in the 19th century just want to swallow the world. They didn't want anything to be left over. They wanted to swallow China and all of Southeast Asia and Africa and South America. They just wanted to swallow everything, you know? And they did a pretty good job of swallowing everything. And then, of course, they wound up having major indigestion and threw up a lot afterwards. Tried to swallow more than they could chew. Your intellect is not big enough to swallow this. The intellect have to rest. You have to let it go. And maintain the flow of cognizance. And then you rest in the emptiness of the mind. Releasing, letting off. Like the image of coming, I'm just telling you what's on my teleprompter. I don't know anything at all. And I got a really great teleprompter. It's, you know, like the rocket ship that's all already gone off. And then it just, and it's the fuel in the lower booster is just all spent. It's done its purpose. And so you don't keep it on out of nostalgia. I'll miss you. You know. No, I just let it fall off. It's empty. It's for service purpose. And it just drops away. And then, whew, and then you take off again. You need to leave the booster rocket of your intellect. You can't bring it there. It's spent its fuel. You've used your intellect for the best possible purpose in the whole universe. Intellect can be used for all kinds of things. Cell phones, warfare, all kinds of stuff. This is actually the best use of your intellect you can ever put it to realize the emptiness of your intellect. The emptiness of your mind. And realizing that, leave your mind behind, leave your intellect behind. Sustain the flow of cognizance, which is nothing other than rikpa. Rikpa is cognizance. Sustain that. But now free, unhindered, unfettered by any of the conceptual categories of existence, non-existence, birth and cessation, coming and going, one and many. They all just fall away. And it's just emptiness. And your luminous cognizance of emptiness. And no duality between the two. And that is no longer shamatha. That's no longer just awareness of awareness. And that's what the whole shamatha was about. So final point before we go to the meditation. I front-loaded it a lot. This really struck me strongly this afternoon. And that is when we're just taking our first steps into Dharma. And almost certainly, unless we have a very superficial motivation, the first step is driven because we're suffering. Not because we're having such a good time and we think Dharma will be even more fun. People who think that get disillusioned really, really quickly. Right. As one old friend of mine, Westerner, he asked me years and years ago, I don't know why you're practicing Dharma. Why are you devoting your whole life to Dharma? And I started to give him a nice Dharma talk, and he just shut me down. I started to give him another Dharma talk, you know, my favorite hits in Buddha Dharma, you know, like Four Noble Truths, Repentance. I started to like give it to him. Shut me down. He shut me down twice. So then I figured, okay, you tell me. And then he did, because there was nothing else to do. And he got it right. Not that I was bored, it was just that there was nothing else to do. because nothing else, everything else was hopeless, put it that way. That was quite simple. For me, that was very straightforward at the age of 21. Everything else is hopeless. No hope. So, you either commit suicide, good luck with that, or it's Dharma. And happily, I encountered, you know, Dharma. So when you take your first step, you're doing it because your mind is all screwed up and you're suffering. And I have a very strong conviction here that if you really want to see results and you see them quickly and you know that your practice of Dharma is really, really helping you, among the three kind of trainings of ethics, samadhi, and wisdom, the one that will help you more than anything else is ethics. It's nonviolence and benevolence. That'll help you more than shamatha or anything else. Much more than vipassana. It'll help you much, much more. Don't meditate for a single moment, I don't care. But just cut out all violence of body, speech, and mind. And view yourself and all sentient beings with benevolence, and that will just transform. It will give you so much sense of ease, such a greater sense of well-being, peace, harmony. People may, you know, you'll still get flack from other people and situations, adversity will still arise, but you'll suffer so much less. You know, even if you've never meditated for a moment. Now, on that basis, if you'd like to find an even deeper sense of well-being and inwardly within your own mind, tapping into this kind of genuine unhappiness, you know, that is not triggered by some adversity here or there, if you'd like to now see, well, okay, that was a really good start, and you'd like to experience a deeper sense of well-being and a deeper freedom from suffering, between shamatha and vipassana, or samadhi and wisdom, my very strong conviction is samadhi is going to be more helpful. If you have to choose, samadhi, mental balance, exceptional sanity, rather than having some keen insight, a little fleeting insight into emptiness or this or that or non-self or whatever, or quantum cosmology or whatever, those would be neat, those would be very entertaining and give you some really cool memories. I've seen this many, many times. Of people given almost no effort, no real cultivation of shamatha, really developing that whole skill set, and practicing Zen or Vajrayana or Dzogchen or this or that, and mind's still very neurotic. I've seen it many, many times. Uptight, neurotic, egotistical, jealous, all the crap. And yet they can tell about some really splendid experiences they've had. And the really well-educated ones can give you a super-duper talk on Madhyamaka. Or Vipassana, or Zen, Dogen, and so forth and so on. Still neurotic. Still neurotic. So the way to make your mind exceptionally sane, supple, malleable, balanced, free of the five obscurations, well, Vipassana wasn't designed to do that. And it doesn't do it very well. And just practicing shamatha was not designed to make you less violent and more benevolent. It wasn't designed to do that. That's at a more basic level, right? And so let ethics do what ethics is really good at. And let the cultivation of samadhi, which includes all four types of mental balance, cognitive, attentional, cognitive, and emotional, let that do its work. It's much better at it than Dzogchen or Vajrayogini or Mahamudra or Chan and so forth. It's just, that was designed to do that. Those practices are really effective at doing that. Much more than more advanced practices. And much more than simply hanging out in ethics. On that level, with shamatha, let's imagine you have achieved shamatha. Okay, so wow, you've really made some real strides in that second of the three trainings. Training in samadhi, training an exceptional mental balance. And imagine that you're really on a track to, just been just profoundly, intuitively drawn to realizing Rigpa, Buddha nature, whether through Chan, Zen, Vajrayana, Mahamudra, Dzogchen, what have you. But let's imagine that's your aspiration, that's what's really captured you. You want to realize Rigpa. If you have a solid foundation in ethics, and you've achieved shamatha, then there are two options here. And that is, one is vipassana. And the other one is just simply sitting in open presence. Choksha. You know, having heard about the view, having some introduction to the view, Dzogchen view, for example. And then having heard that, gently just sitting open presence. Like that. And never mind Vipassana, such a hassle. Just, I like to rest here. That or Vipassana? Which one's going to be more effective? It's Vipassana. It's Vipassana. Because if you've not done the work of Vipassana, if you've not penetrated into the reification of the observer, awareness itself, as that which is observing, that which is thinking, that which is the mind, if you've not penetrated into the emptiness of that, if there's still an unchallenged reification of the observer, the mind, then there's an unchallenged reification of objects, because that comes with the territory, which means there's an unchallenged reification of the bifurcation of subject and object. Dualistic grasping has not been touched. It's gone a bit softer because you've achieved shamatha. But you have not stepped one step onto the path yet. And so if you just skip that, because Vipassana is such a hassle, and so annoying and stressful and exasperating, and you're no good at it, you say, boy, I'm good at shamatha, and I think I can be pretty darn good at just sitting. Well, you're sitting on your own tomb. Because there's that concrete between you and Rigpa. And the concrete is a reification. The crusty, gnarly reification of your mind. And just sitting there, hoping it's going to go away by itself. Not likely. That's why Pinchen Rinpoche, that's why Dujum Lingpa, that's why these great masters are teaching Vipassana, Vipassana, Vipassana. To break it up like an ice floe. Break it up. Shatter it. Drop that Coke bottle until it shatters. The reification of subject shatters. The reification of object then shatters. The bifurcation of the two shatters. It shatters. Slip into this non-conceptual mode of cognizance. Resting with your fusion of shamatha vipassana in the emptiness of your own mind. And now between you and Rigpa there's like a paper wall, like in a Japanese house. There's still a wall. That is, it's not enough to realize the emptiness of your mind. That doesn't by itself guarantee that you'll cut through to Rigpa. But between you and Rigpa is a paper wall. Right. And all you need is then pointing out instructions. And that wall is ripped. So there's a sequence. Let ethics do its work. Let shamatha do its work. Because they each do their own work better than anything else. Let vipassana do its work. Shamatha doesn't do it well. Rigpa doesn't do it. Stage regeneration completion don't do it well. If you've not practiced vipassana, good luck with your stage regeneration practice. You're just doing like, you know, cops and robbers are playing dolls. You know, I'm Andrushi, you want to be Tara? And let's play, you know? In fact, let's get it on. You know? Just, you know, then you have all this malarkey, all this tantric bullshit that just gives rise to confusion and more confusion and more confusion while carrying the banner, I'm a Vajrayana practitioner or I'm a Dzogchen meditator. You know, big deal. So there it is. Let each one do its work. And when in that interface between ethics, samadhi, and then we have vipassana. In that interface between vipassana and then cutting through to pristine awareness, that's where you can bring in some real auxiliary troops that may serve you extremely well. And that's stage regeneration and completion. Absolutely indispensable? No. Enormously helpful for many, many practitioners? Yep. Yep. Let them do their work. Because the stage regeneration and completion based upon pure ethics, bodhisattva precepts, shamatha, and vipassana, now you can be a bona fide Vajrayana practitioner. And it can actually do the work for which it was designed. Right? And that is soften everything up. That is the stage regeneration and the multiple stages of completion, all designed for the fourth empowerment, the name empowerment, the word empowerment. And that's Mahamudra. That's Dzogchen. Right? So let each phase do its work. And you can actually come to full awakening. A Buddhahood in the palm of the hand. Skip any of those stages. I'll see how that turns out. Let's practice. The difference between Buddhas and sentient beings is that Buddhas know who they are, sentient beings do not. So with the aspiration to know who you have always been, from your very ground, settle your body, speech, and mind in the natural state. Let your awareness come to rest, at ease, free of grasping, but sustaining, all importantly, sustaining the non-conceptual flow of cognizance. With no interest in any appearances or objects arising to the mind, single-pointedly focus your awareness in the flow of cognizance of being aware, the process, awareness happening, awareness aware of awareness happening. It's okay that thoughts come up. That's what they do. Let them arise. Let them arise of their own accord, self-arising, without intervention, without blocking them or perpetuating them. Let them release themselves with no ripples, with no repercussions, with no wavering of this unflickering candle flame of your own awareness. And examine your own experience very carefully. Don't slip into a conceptual mode, a philosophical, analytical mode, but rather one of precise observation. As you're resting in that flow of being aware, of being aware, of being aware, is there a sense? This is not a rhetorical question, and there's no right answer except for what you actually observe. Is there a sense? Of a subject, someone, something. Call it you, call it your mind as the basis of designation of you. That is the one in here that is aware of awareness. The referent of the noun, mind. This word means something to you. You've used it many, many times. There's no question that you have a mind. There's no question that you're using it to meditate. So now examine very closely what is the basis of designation of this noun. The mind that is observing. The mind that brings forth thoughts. The conceptual mind that identifies mind. And that said, it is a certainty that the conceptual mind designates mind upon a basis of designation. What is that basis of designation? Search for the mind that is the subject, that is in here, observing, and see if you can find it, as it exists from its own side, really in here. Search carefully, so that upon the conclusion of your search, you'll not simply conclude, I don't know, or I couldn't find it. Search until you make a discovery. If you can find it, identify it. And if you search so carefully and with such thoroughness, using your powers of course examination and subtle analysis, which will be there waiting for you and upon the achievement of shamatha, but you can already utilize them. If upon thorough and precise analysis, investigation, searching, if you don't merely intellectually conclude, but you empirically discover, there is no mind in here to be found. Sustain the cognizance of the unfindability of the mind, the emptiness of the mind. Rest there, non-conceptually, in this space-like meditative equipoise, free of all conceptual elaborations. And to facilitate that, I will now stop speaking. Let's continue in silence. So let's seamlessly segue from the meditation back to the text. Vinaya Murti, in his commentary to his own root text, writes, well, when you are in equipoise on ultimate reality, do dependently arisen phenomena appear as just nominal, as mere imputations, when you're resting there in meditation, in that space-like awareness, space-like meditative equipoise? The reply is expressed thusly. He goes right back to his own root text. Thus, within proper equipoise on ultimate reality, you are free from the extremes of conceptual elaborations of samsara and nirvana, such as existence, non-existence, and so forth. So the very notion of conventional reality, names, labels, conceptual categories, they're not there at all when you're simply resting there. You're resting free of the extremes of conceptual elaborations, which means all constructs, all conceptual categories, all names, all words, including the very distinction between samsara and nirvana. You're free. You've gotten some, as they say, give me some space. You got some space. The exalted Mila, as in Milarepa, says, in this regard, so here he is tapping right into the Kagyu Mahamudra tradition, the lineage, the exalted Mila says, where ultimate truth holds sway, there is no Buddhahood separate from obstructions. So there's no division, there's no distinction, again, of names, categories, Buddhahood and samsara, Buddhahood and obstructions. There is no Buddhahood separate from obstructions. There is no meditator, no object of meditation, no stages to be traversed or signs of the path. There are no resultant Buddha bodies, as in Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, and Manakaya, or gnosis, as in primordial consciousness. There are no categories at all, therefore there is no nirvana. Everything is merely imputed by names and words. That's for those people who are not in meditative equipoise. That's their problem. But you've transcended as you're resting there non-conceptually in meditative equipoise. You're not conceptually imputing everything, anything. The three worlds, animate and inanimate, three worlds are form, formless, or desire, form, and formless realms. Or, alternatively, the worlds below, the worlds on the surface of the earth and above. So there's nagas below, for example, there are fish below, there are all of us land creatures, and then there are those in the sky. The three worlds, animate and inanimate, from the beginning do not exist, so there is no arising. So this will be reminiscent of the Heart Sutra, and that is relative to emptiness, there is no suffering, no cause of suffering, no liberation, no path, and so forth. There's no attainment, no non-attainment. So he goes on, and well, he's making the same point. From the beginning, these three worlds do not exist, so there is no arising, there is no basis, there is no conate, as in conate mental afflictions and so forth. There is no action or ripening of action. Therefore, not even the name of samsara exists. The final reality appears like that. That's where you rest. It is said that the perfection of wisdom cannot be expressed by speech or thought. And it's by its very nature is ineffable and inconceivable. It's not that you're not articulate enough. And even if you're speaking with someone, even if you have achieved the perfection of wisdom, gained such profound insight, and you're speaking with someone else with profound insight, speaking out of your intellect to another person's intellect, you still can't do it. Okay. That is, it just by very nature transcends all conceptual elaborations, whether in the mind or articulated through speech. And as the scholar adept, the pundit Siddha Kyungbo teaches, worldly appearances are self-releasing, like illusions or dreams. They're gone, they simply have no footing when you're resting in meditative equipoise. Well, if that is so, so now he's just kind of focused in, that's what it's like, insofar as words can point to that which is inexpressible, what about then the rest of reality, that is, the world where, you know, the world we're living in? Well, if that is so, are actions and the results and so forth utterly non-existent, since they have no footing, they have no place, when you're resting simply in the emptiness of the mind? Does that mean, then, that they don't exist at all? They're utterly non-existent. It is said that although they do not exist ultimately, which means they do not exist really or inherently. Their non-existence is not utterly settled. That is, don't just settle there, don't think, now I've got it. They don't exist at all, since action and its result and so forth very much exist. And then Roger Jackson quite helpfully put in, conventionally, that is on a relative level. I'll pause there. There's a phrase today which is kind of leaping to mind today. Very, very important. And it comes. The phrase comes from my Galupa training. And that is, when you want to engage meaningfully with the world around you, with other sentient beings, if you want to meaningfully cultivate the four immeasurables, for example, or the four greats, or you'd like to provide some service, you just want to engage, maybe you like to, you know, act on behalf of the environment, to preserve the environment, and so forth. If you wish to meaningfully engage with the world around you, including other sentient beings, of course, then the phrase that comes up is mata mache. Mata, don't investigate, don't analyze. What this means is, do not engage in ontological investigation. Because if I'm cultivating loving kindness for a person like Francesca, if I cultivate loving kindness, and then as I'm doing this, I said, well, why don't we really get it on? And I'll apply some ultimate analysis here. Okay, Francesca, I want to develop loving kindness for you. But by the way, are you your body? No. Are you your mind? No. Are you the combination of both? Are you either one? Do you exist separately? And then suddenly, I'm kind of looking into empty space. Where did Francesca go? I was meditating on someone a moment ago. And now she's not there. She has only nominal status. She's only conventionally existent. It's hard to develop anything really deeply from the heart from someone who has only a nominal existence. Right? Or, moreover, if you're focusing right into the emptiness, and that's the real point here, if you're really doing that ontological probe and you're going right into the nature of the individual and coming up with emptiness, you never feel empathy or loving kindness or compassion for emptiness. The sheer absence of inherent existence of anything, people or anybody else, not going to happen. So there's a point when you suspend ontological analysis, because that will always lead to the same place. It will always lead to emptiness. It's always going to lead to space like meditative equipoise, where there's no Francesca, no non-Francesca, no human beings and no non-human beings, no conceptual categories whatsoever. So there's no object of loving kindness when you're resting in space like meditative equipoise. But as he's making here so clear, and with very few words, this does not negate that it's a profound insight you're having and dwelling in while in space-like meditative equipoise, does not negate the world around you, which is filled with causal patterns, actions and their consequences, the laws of nature, physics, biology, chemistry, and so forth, and human suffering and mental afflictions and striving on the path and so forth and so on. It doesn't negate that. And so insofar as you want to engage with this phenomenal world, then do bring your intelligence to bear. Engage in phenomenological investigation. So if a person is behaving in a very unwholesome way, well, then examine what are the causes and conditions. What gave rise to this? And then understand it. And then also as we attend to, as I highlighted quite at some length earlier, and I have to be brief, but when we're attending to, well, what is the object? Where is that dimension of Francesca that anyone could see if they could see this deeply, that is lovable and always lovable, whatever mood she's in, whatever behavior she's conducting, that's always there, right? Without going to the emptiness of Francesca, because that's not lovable at all. It's a sheer absence, it's a simple negation, right? So on that conventional level, that relative level, which is not negated by the emptiness of Francesca, where is that? On the surface level, we have Francesca being very friendly, but maybe not always friendly. Very wholesome, but not always. Very appealing, but sometimes probably unappealing. If you're like me, I don't quite know, but you know, it's like that. But not always manifesting lovable qualities. There are some people, I imagine, do. I'm not one of them. But if Francesca's like me, then not always lovable in terms of how we're appearing. What's always there? Well, that brightly shining mind. Luminous, pure, the source of a yearning that is a relative level, that which keeps her moving, seeking, wanting to find happiness, wanting to be free of suffering, saturated by loving kindness. That's always lovable. If you could see it, if you could just have X-ray vision and see right through the veneers of the gender, the age, the ethnicity, the personal history, the degree of mental affliction she does or does not have. If you could just see through all of that, like with, you know, yogic x-ray vision, then you'd see something that's just an ongoing stream of someone who's truly lovable. And that's the basis of designation. That brightly shining mind is not a person, but you say, I'm very happy to designate Francesca on that. Because then she's always lovable. And everybody is. Mao Zedong, Hitler, Mussolini, Donald Trump. Maybe I shouldn't quite have put them in the same kind of... Putin, me, you know. All of us on that level, always equally lovable. You know, the greatest villains of history, their brightly shining mind was still brightly shining. It was just heavily obscured. You know. And for all of us, to varying extents, it gets obscured. But it doesn't go out. It says, not like dousing a lamp, you remember? Not like that. Always there. So there we go. But that's on the conventional level. But it's a really good basis of designation. It's a valid basis of designation. It's also valid to say, Francesca's tall. Okay, but don't get a whole lot of mileage out of that, a whole lot of benefit. It's perfectly valid. She's tall. What's the basis of designation? Tall body. Okay. So there we are. Let's move on then. But ever so important to see that neither of these two truths negates the other, obscures, overwhelms the other. So he continues in his root text, yet when you arise from that state, rise from that space-like meditative equipoise, and analyze, now you're investigating not how phenomena don't exist, but how do they exist? Right? Because he just said all of these very much exist, actions and, you know, actions and the results and so forth. When you arise from that state and analyze simply due to nominal imputation, by the power of nominal or conceptual designation, dependently arisen events, including actions and agents, undeniably appear, naturally, like a dream, a mirage, the moon in water, or an illusion. And it's very important to recognize all of those have causal efficacy. Dreams influence your brain, they influence your mood, your emotions. They influence your body. When you wake up, you can still have repercussions from the dream preceding, whether it was a magnificent lucid dream or whether it was a horrific nightmare. Dreams have causal efficacy. The people that appear in the dreams, those people that appear in the dreams and what they do to you, they have causal efficacy, right? And they don't exist. They're not there. They're empty appearances. But they can make you miserable. They can terrify you. Or you can have a vision of the Buddha giving you oral transmission, you know, and bliss you out, maybe even pointing out instructions. I knew one fellow who was in a dream, is actually quite good at lucid dreaming, and he was just having a non-lucid dream, and he bumped into someone, I can't remember who it was, and the person just looked at him and said, you know, this is a dream? He became lucid. Yeah, cool. You know, you should have people like that pop in your dream more often. So you might just bump into somebody who helps become lucid. That person then had causal efficacy that tripped you over from non-lucidity to lucidity. Now, that is something. That something really happened. That has a real impact. All right. So dreams have causal efficacy. Mirages, you can photograph them and so forth. And the moon and water, you can read a newspaper by it, if it's a full moon and big print. And then illusions. Like I put on the website, you know, the notes for this retreat, a very cool link that Mary Kay sent me of this fellow, you know, with the avatar and the holographic projections. If you saw it, it's quite cool. And those appearances, including having a conversation with a man from NASA, who's elsewhere, of course, and they're having a conversation going back and forth. And one is a holographic image, and the other is dreamlike. We call him a person, right? But one empty appearance having a conversation with another appearance, and they both influence each other. Very important. That holographic image wasn't really there, of course. And yet it's influencing things, and is influenced by the speaker. They had a conversation back and forth. So this is very cool. Jay Miller, as in Jay Milarepa, also states, so now he's coming back. Having referred to the complete transconceptuality of resting in space like equipoise, then he comes back to conventional reality. Emma, like Emma, oh my goodness. Oh my goodness, if there were no sentient beings, whence would come the Buddhas of the three times? Where would they come from? Since a result without a cause is impossible, in the realm of conventional truth, everything in samsara and nirvana exists. So said the sage. Existence, the appearance of entities, and non-existence, the ultimate reality that is emptiness, these two have natures that are inseparable and of a single taste. Ultimate reality, relative reality. So different, and yet of the same nature. They're not two entities slapped together. They're not two different domains, types of reality. But one can say they're rather the same reality. Form is emptiness. Emptiness is form. From this perspective, you see it as form. From this perspective, you see it as emptiness. So the distinction of our own awareness, oh, he really cuts to the core. So the distinction of our own awareness and others' awareness does not exist. All is vast and unified. So suffering has no owner, virtuousness has no owner, awareness has no owner. It suffices then to say that entities' way of existing, how do they exist? We know how they appear. They appear, they lie. They appear in a manner in which they don't exist. But entity's way of existing is to exist as merely nominal, merely imputed for the supreme Arya Nagarjunapada, the reverend or the venerable. There you go. Nagarjuna states, I just dropped something here. Everything well? Okay. Okay. States, as Nagarjuna states, because physical things are merely nominal, this is interesting, this has a big wallop. Because physical things are merely nominal, space also is merely nominal. So we tend to think of physical space as really out there, of course. Like how long does it take to send a rocket to the nearest possibly habitable planet? It's 40 light years away, right? Merely 40 light, but it's millions of years. It seems like that's a lot of real space out there. Real space. Yeah? And he's saying, well, no. Time is conceptually designated with no conceptual designation. Time is, frozen. Remember? Without introducing the subject, without introducing the observer, and I think there's a complete common ground between this particular interpretation of quantum mechanics, namely quantum cosmology, without introducing the observer with his clock, and the clock says now. You look at the clock and it says now. And relative to now, you have past, and relative to now, you have future, and now the universe, from that perspective, unfolds. Time is conceptually designated. No conceptual designation, no time. That's why when you're resting non-conceptually in emptiness, you're resting in a domain that is timeless. When you're resting in Rigpa, which means you're also resting in the realization of emptiness, it's in the fourth time. It's not in past, present, or future. It's not even in the present. It's in the fourth time. There's no conceptual designation, therefore there's no conceptual designation of time. And there is no time from that perspective, and there is no space. Thus, the final significance of the Mahamudra view, as described by the Arya father, Nagarjuna, and his spiritual son, Aryadeva, the final significance of the Mahamudra view, and he's fusing this entirely with the Madhyamaka, which is well said, was clearly explained by saying imputed existence, just nominal. That is, this whole phenomenal world, from a Higgs boson up to galactic clusters and so on, they do exist relative to the cognitive frame of reference in which they've been identified, and they exist as something merely conceptually imputed or designated. Their status is nominal. So I wonder if the Large Hadron Supercollider would still get its funding if everybody's persuaded that everything we're discovering exists only as names. No wonder there's such resistance to challenging metaphysical realism. There are enormous vested interests in maintaining that status quo. Very profitable. For example, one must acknowledge, so here's just a simple point. For example, or as an analogy really, one must acknowledge that there are pillars inside a house with four pillars because it has four pillars. That's what we say. A house with a roof held up by four pillars, it has pillars because it has four pillars in the house. I mean, kind of like, come on, let's get real. Pillar, the term, generically, is a universal. That is, pillar applies to every pillar. There's a skinny one, there's a pillar, but there's a fat one. There's a pillar. Some are made of stone, some are made of wood, some are made of clay. But pillar is universal. It applies to anything that is a pillar that corresponds to our agreed, conceptually agreed upon definition of pillar. It could be a pile of rocks. It could be a person. Hold up the roof. Stand really tall. Don't move, because the roof's going to collapse if you move. I've just designated you as a pillar. Good. If you're performing the function of the pillar, then be a pillar. So pillar is a universal that pervades each of the four pillars. That is, it's applicable to each of them. What then is the definitional basis of the substance universal? This is techno talk. Don't worry about it too much. Definitional basis, that is, what is being defined? What is the basis that you're defining of the substance universal pillar? When you search, none of the four pillars is individually suitable as the definitional basis. That is, from its own side, in their basis of designation, you don't find pillar, nor are the four collectively its definitional basis. You know, you can virtually read here basis of designation. So they are not the basis of designation individually, not there, collectively not there, nor is its definitional basis a cause shown to be anything other than just the four individually and collectively. He's making the same points, but more, how do you say, philosophically here. I'm just going to move through it. Thus, the substance universal pillar, that is inside the pillars, is a mere nominal designation, pillar on the four pillars. If you haven't gotten it yet, then just stop. If you search for something apart from what is sufficiently described as a mere nominal imputation, you're looking for the real pillar. It is not found, so all phenomena equally are to be described as imputed existence, just nominal. And as I was just reading this on my teleprompter, there came a very vivid memory of when I was receiving the autobiography of Geshe Rabten, and I'd hike up to his little cow shed up in the mountains, and he got, as he was coming to the kind of conclusion of his life story, and he'd finished his training as a Geshe, graduated with highest honors, and then went off and lived in this cow shed, and he was you know, superbly trained in Madhyamaka, and an outstanding debater, really quite renowned. And so there he was, rather than debating or heading a monastery or doing any kind of stuff that would give him bigger reputation, he told me he'd be sitting in his cabin, and there was a pillar, just basically a tree stump, holding up the roof, for which the rafters were branches, and the roof was slate from the nearby slate mine just across the way, very much like this, a slate mine just across the way. But it was donkeys that would carry these big bags of slate. In any case, his roof, his very heavy roof, it's made of these heavy, heavy, beautiful gray slates, is all being held up with the rafters, and then the pillar. And he'd be sitting on his meditation cushion, attending to that pillar, and analyzing the pillar to see whether it was really there from its own side. Right? And he said, and I can almost quote him verbatim, it's there in the book, The Life and Teaching of Geshe Rabten, which is now out of print, but they came up with a new version, which I don't care for that much. But he said, as I was meditating on that, he said, well, I think I'll stop there. Because if I went on and told you what I've experienced, you'd think I'm completely crazy. And then he just dropped it. Now, there is a... Okay, I'm going to move from this one quickly as well, because we just don't need to get bogged down. Please don't agonize over this. There is a qualm. This is a scholar's qualm. And if you're not a scholar, then you don't need this qualm. And if you are a scholar and you have a qualm, then it has to be clarified. But if you don't have a qualm, then it doesn't have to be clarified. So it's your choice. But if you have a qualm already, then he's going to help you. There is a qualm that must be clarified. Some earlier and later writers connected with Prasangika school say all cognitions of ordinary individuals are mistaken cognitions. That is, you're deluded all the time. And for that reason, any and all appearances that arise in the minds of ordinary individuals arise and appear as inherently existent. Okay, well, we've heard that before. Everything appears in a way it isn't. You apprehend them in a way they are not. Therefore, you're deluded. Everything at all time. The Svatantrika assertion, okay, there are two sub-schools of Madhyamaka, Prasangika, which is the widely regarded as the ultimate one, certainly the one that Benjamin Moche embraces as the deepest interpretation of Madhyamaka view. And then there's a Svatantrika, the runner-up. The Svatantrika assertion that the object of negation is apprehended as having a truly existent way of appearing that is other than its present way of appearing. does not enable us to say that what appears in the minds of ordinary individuals like us does not exist as it appears. So it is erroneous. That should be just transparent and clear, so I'm just going to move right on. And you can read that over and over again until it comes clear if you need that. What he's going to clarify a little bit more. Thus, Svatantrika scholars who assert that form and so forth do exist by virtue of their appearance to an undamaged mind, that is, one that's not distorted, is not sick, you're not hallucinating, what have you. So do assert that form and so forth do exist by virtue of their appearance to an undamaged mind should think well about how Sri Chandrakirti, the great advocate of the Prasangika, refuted this assertion. Indeed, to the sense cognitions of commoners, remember non-Aryas, the five types of objects appear to be established self-sufficiently. Okay, we've heard that before. They appear to be existing from their own side, even though they are not established on their own. If you try to find them as they are on their own, you can't find them. Thus, those cognitions are mistaken. Fair enough. When one applies inferential authority to the point of view in which appearances of the five objects exist by way of their own characteristics, then it is valid to describe them as conventions. This must be understood. I could spend a lot of time on that, but I'm not sure it would be really worth the time. I think we can just move on because the whole text is so wonderfully empirical. But he is a great scholar, and he is very rightly assumes many of the people reading this text over the last 400 years are also very well-versed scholars. And this could clarify from some serious qualms for them. It's that scalpel identifying the difference in understanding of object of negation from the Prasangika perspective and the Svatantrika Madhyamika. Okay? It's subtle. I think I could expound it somewhat. I'm just not going to now. The geshis here could definitely do that superbly. I don't even know who they are. But any well-trained geshi can nail that one. So, also many think that it is said that the truly existent person, not the person as such, so kind of like this conceptual construct, a truly existent person, not me, or not Michelle, or not Lim, but, you know, the truly existent person, they concoct something they call the truly existent person, not the person as such, is negated. So while in equipoise, they set aside this whole person, the person they actually feel themselves to be, and try to negate a truly existent person created by the mind. So they create a straw man, and then refute the straw man, and they come out unscathed. Well, what was the point of that? Clever, clever, clever. This is completely unacceptable because it entails the extreme of permanence. You haven't really gotten out of the bog of substantialism and metaphysical realism. You're still resting in ordinary sense of I am, and then concocting a straw man and then defeating that with logic. Although there's much more to discuss, I fear to write too much, so that must suffice. Phew! We're out of that thicket. Again, Glenn, I think, could explain a lot of these things, probably better than I. I've just given him a big burden. Don't hassle him too much. So, showing the way to manifest the excellent path free of the extremes of eternalism, that's metaphysical realism, and nihilism, nothing exists at all, by meditating thusly. The root text says, when the empty is not obstructed by appearances, the emptiness of inherent nature is not overwhelmed or obstructed by appearances arising. And appearances are not terminated, they're not negated. I meant to say negated. And appearances are not negated by the empty. So just that is clear. Then you actualize the excellent path where emptiness and dependent arising have a single meaning. In accord with this, the omniscient Jeet Tsongkhapa says, this very famous quote from him, as for the belief that undeceiving dependent appearances and the empty, or emptiness, are two separate things, it's very easy to reify both. As long as they appear individually, that is, when you are immersed in emptiness, you're totally out of touch with phenomena, and when you're really focusing on phenomena, you're totally out of touch with emptiness, as if they're incompatible. As long as they appear sequentially or individually as something quite separate, the sage's meaning still will not be realized. You haven't got the point yet. When, without alternation, you simultaneously simply see dependently related events as non-deceptive, and destroy all manner of grasping at objects of determinate cognition, and that would destroy all reification, then your examination of the view will be complete. So, to rephrase that just a little bit, when your very insight into the very nature of phenomena as being dependent related events immediately points to the emptiness of inherent nature, and your insight into the emptiness of phenomena immediately points to their being, then their arising as dependent related events, now you've got the point. Because now you're seeing them non-dually, seeing the same reality from two complementary perspectives. Then your examination of the view will be complete. Then you've got it. And that just, it just occurred to me as I was reading it, my teleprompter just gave me another little cool little thing. Stillness and motion. Emptiness is by nature primordially still. It doesn't come and go, it's not arising and passing, it doesn't go anywhere. Emptiness by nature still, it's primordially still. Phenomena, form and so forth, was on the move. All is changing. So simultaneously, resting in the awareness of the stillness of emptiness and seeing the movements as being nothing other than manifestations of, emerging from, emptiness. That just raised that whole issue of stillness and motion to a whole other level. Which is to say the middle way. That's the middle way view. Get that one and you're very close to Mahamudra. You're very close to Dzogchen. So, alas, it is dinner time. Enjoy your dinner. See you tomorrow.